Osho, The Perfect Master, Volume 1, Talks on Sufi Stories, Discourse Number 1, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
Bhagwan. A certain man decided that he would seek the perfect master.
Yeah.
Bhagwan. A certain man decided that he would seek the perfect master. He read many books, visited sage after sage, listened, discussed and practiced, but he always found himself doubting or unsure. After 20 years, he met a man whose every word and action corresponded with his idea of the totally realized man. The traveler lost no time. "You," he said, "seem to me to be the perfect master. If you are, my journey is at an end." "I am, indeed, described by that name," said the master. "Then, I beg of you, accept me as a disciple." "That," said the master, "I cannot do. For while you may desire the perfect master, he, in turn, requires only the perfect pupil."
The master appears only when the disciple is ready, never otherwise, in no other way, at no other point in life's journey. The disciple has to be ready and ripe only at that moment. The master becomes visible. The disciple has to earn eyes, to earn ears, to create an heart, to feel. How can the sun appear if you are blind? The sun may appear, but you will go on missing it. Unless you have eyes, there is no beauty in the world. The flowers will bloom, but not for you. And the stars will fill the sky with immense beauty, but not for you. Unless you have eyes, there is no beauty in the world. If you don't have love in the heart, you will not find the beloved. The basic requirement has to be fulfilled. Only love finds the beloved. Eyes find beauty, and the ears find music and melodies. But there are people, and there are many. The majority consists of those who go on searching and seeking something out there without creating a corresponding receptivity in them. I have come across many seekers who are searching for a master, not at all aware that the disciple is completely absent. The disciple is not there at all. How can you find a master? The master is not just an objective phenomenon there. First, he has to be something interior in you. That's what disciplehood is. A preparation, a thirst, a passionate desire, a great passion for truth that is lacking. And then people go on searching. And if they don't find, it is not surprising. They are not going to find. They may come across many masters, but they will go on missing. How can you see the master if you are not vulnerable to him? How can you see the master if you don't know even what is to be a disciple? The beginning of the finding of a master starts by being a disciple. The real seeker does not worry about the master, where he is. His whole concern is how to create the disciple in him. How to be a learner, open to reality. How to function from innocence. And how not to function from the state of knowledge. If you function from the state of knowledge, you will find many teachers, but never a master. If you already know something, and you think that you know, then you will find other knowers, claimers who are ahead of you. You will meet only the people whom you can meet. You will meet people like you. A person who functions from the state of knowing that he has gathered will find many teachers and will learn many things, but will never find a master. To find a master, you have to be a child. To find a master, you have to be utterly innocent. Not knowing anything. The mind empty. Full of passion for truth, but without any conclusions about it. This is the state of real learning. And then you need not even go anywhere. The master will come to you. There are many sannyasins here who have not come because of their search to me, but I have found them. They have come because of me, not because of themselves. That is the real coming. When you come because of yourself, you don't come at all. You remain there, stubbornly, too much of you, full of you. There is no space for me to enter in you. This is one of the basic requirements for a seeker, that he should be a learner. What I mean by learning is that one should always function from the state of innocence. One should not carry conclusions inside himself, because those conclusions won't allow you to learn. If something goes against them, you are bound to reject it. And if something does not go against them, then you are not learning anything. Only your old prejudice is strengthened more. If something agrees with you, there is no learning. It has simply strengthened the old mind. And the master cannot do it. He has to destroy the old for the new to be. He has to take away all that you have been carrying all along. He has to create a space in you. If you cling to conclusions, prejudices, ideas, philosophies, you will not be able to meet a master. Because his whole work consists in destroying all kind of philosophies. He is interested in the real thing. He is not worried in speculation about things. Just the other day I was reading a statement of Burke. Most people will grant that potatoes are important. Discourse about potatoes, however, does not enjoy the same popularity as potatoes. When the chips are down, talk about potatoes is just no substitute for the original thing. So it is with religion. I like the statement. The master is interested in the real potatoes, not philosophies about the potatoes. And if you come with conclusions, you can't come. Those conclusions stand like great barriers between you and the master. One has to come open, available. One has to come not knowing. This should be obvious. If you know already, then you are not available. Your very knowledge obstructs the way. Become a disciple. Don't be worried about the master. When you are ready, the master appears. The master appears in strange ways sometimes. But it always happens. Whenever someone is ripe, God starts coming in many forms to him. The master is the last form of God that comes to the disciple. After the master, there is formlessness. He is the last experience of form. Beyond him, there is formlessness. Then there is God with no form. The master is the last who looks like you, who lives like you, whom you can touch, to whom you can have a dialogue, who speaks like you. Beyond the master is silence, utter, absolute, virgin. Beyond the master is bodilessness. The master is just exactly in between the world and God. If you are really tired of the world and the rut and the routine of it, don't start searching for a master. Rather, search how to become a disciple. Start unburdening yourself from prejudices, dogmas. Forget all that you know. Maharishi Raman used to say to his disciples that if you want to be with me, you will have to unlearn. If you don't unlearn, then I have nothing to give to you. you are already too full. You know the famous Zen story? A professor of philosophy went to see a great master. And he asked about God, and he asked about karma, and he asked about the theory of reincarnation, and he asked many things, questions and questions and questions. And the master said, "You are tired. The journey has been long. And I can see you are perspiring, coming uphill in such a hot summer afternoon. It must have been tiring. You wait, there is no hurry. These questions can wait a little. Let me prepare a cup of tea for you. And who knows, while drinking the tea, you may get the answer." Now the professor was a little puzzled and became a little suspicious whether it was right to come this madman. How the questions can be answered just by drinking tea? But now there was no way of going. He had to rest a little. And the tea is not going to hurt in any way. So why not drink it and escape from here? The master brought the tea. He started pouring from his kettle into the cup and went on pouring. The cup was full and the tea started overflowing in the saucer. And the saucer was full. Then the professor said, "Stop! What are you doing? The tea will start overflowing on the floor." Now the cup has not even a space for a single drop. Are you mad or something? And the master had a hearty laugh and he said, "So, you are intelligent. You can understand. If there is no space in the cup, then we cannot pour any more tea into it. Is there a space in your head? I would like to pour all that I am, but is there a space in your head? Is it not overfull? Too much stuffed?" "This is my answer," the master said. "Come again. First empty your head. Come in a state of not knowing. You are too knowledgeable. I can hear all the noise that is going on inside you. Come a little more in silence. And you have not come to learn, you have come to argue. Knowledge always hankers to argue. It is not interested in learning. In learning it feels humiliated. That's why it becomes more and more difficult. The more grown up you are, the less is the possibility of your learning anything. Children can learn because they don't have any ego. And they learn fast. And they learn very easily. The same thing if you have to learn when you are 35 or 40 or 50 is very difficult. Almost impossible sometimes. What happens to your intelligence? After 50 years of experience, your intelligence should be more than it was before. But it is not. You have gathered much junk on the way. The functioning of the intellect is no more free. It is too much burdened. And burdened with crap. And you feel humiliated in learning anything. You cannot bow down. You cannot say, "I do not know." And the disciple is one who can say, I do not know, teach me. I am ready to learn. I have not come with any conclusions to you. I have not brought any knowledge. I come empty. Fill me. The real search is how to become a disciple. How to empty the cup of your being. So when you come across a being who is overflowing with God, you can be filled. Filled to your heart's content. But people search a master. They don't search disciplehood. That's where they go on missing. Then you will come across many, many people and you will always feel unsatisfied. And the reason of unsatisfaction is not outside you. It comes from your own inner mind. You have brought conclusions with you. I was reading the other day about a very beautiful Hasid mystic, Levi Itzhak. He was so full of God and the song of God and the dance of God that when he will worship or pray, he will go wild. It is said about him that he simply radiated the divine dance in its total wildness. He worshipped with such abandon that the frightened faithful instinctively moved away. If he will be worshipping in the temple, people will escape to their homes because his worship was very wild. He gesticulated, howled, and danced, jumping from one corner to the other, pushing and overturning whatever was in his way. People ceased to exist for him. When he prayed, he himself ceased to exist. Now, if you have come with some conclusions already that how a master should be, you will think he is a madman. If you think a master should be just sitting like a Buddha under a Bo tree, and this madman turning things upside down and running all over the place, and he has scared the worshippers. They have all run out because nobody knows what he is going to do. But this man was a perfect master. God descends in many forms. Sometimes as Buddha, and sometimes as Krishna, and sometimes as Mahavira, and sometimes as Muhammad. And God comes always in new forms, and your conclusions are always from the old. If you are born in a Buddhist family, how can you think this mad Hasid mystic can be a Buddha? Impossible. If you go with a conclusion, you will be in difficulty. If, and there were many disciples of this mad Hasid, if they come across Buddha, they will deny. They will not be satisfied with Buddha. They will say, where is his dance? Why he is not a howling? Just sitting silently under the Bodhi tree? What kind of master is he? But we go on carrying deep-rooted prejudices in us. And remember, those prejudices may look very rational to you. Just the other day, Anadi has asked a question, that Bhagwan, now I cannot trust you anymore. What has happened to Anadi? Why he cannot trust me anymore? A simple thing. I said that the same tree exists in Bodh Gaya under which Buddha became enlightened. And the same tree still vibrates with something of the quality of the Buddha, of that beautiful morning when Buddha disappears and God appeared in him. Now he quotes a history book and says it is written in the history books that the tree was cut and destroyed by a Hindu king. And the temple was converted into a Hindu shrine. So how can the same tree exist? If the history books are right, I am wrong. And how can Anadi trust me when I go against the history books? Don't be so short of trust. And don't be in such a hurry. If I say something, wait, search, and you will find the way. Just reading a history book and your trust is destroyed. I still say it is the same tree. And the history books are right. The shrine was converted into a Hindu shrine and the tree was destroyed. But before the tree was destroyed, Asoka sent a part of the tree, a branch of the tree to Ceylon to be planted there. So the tree continued in Ceylon. Then when the shrine was converted again into a Buddhist temple, a branch of the tree from Ceylon was brought back and replanted. It is the same continuum. It is the same tree. And according to Buddha, even the same tree is never the same for two consecutive moments. It changes. It is continuously changing. Your body changes continuously. In 7 years' time, your body is completely new. The old disappears and the new has taken place. Not even a single cell remains of the old. But it is a continuity. The same in the sense of the continuity. It is the same tree in the Buddhist, in the scientific sense. But don't be in a hurry. If you lose trust so fast and so soon and so easily, it is not much worth. It is not trust really. You go on keeping in the background your prejudices. And you go on watching. When you can find something that you can mistrust, you are more interested in mistrust than in trust. You are trusting in spite of you. Your natural tendency is to mistrust and doubt. You will feel very good if you can doubt. If you cannot find anything to doubt, you may start feeling suffocated. Because with the doubt, your ego is back on the throne. With trust, the ego has to commit suicide. This is a beautiful parable. And Sufis are past masters in parables. Sufis know how to say things which cannot be said in parables. They have created the best parables in the world. Go slowly into this parable. It is a small but of immense significance. A parable is a way of saying things in an indirect way. Truth cannot be asserted directly. That is too violent, too aggressive, too male. Truth can be only said in a very indirect way. It can be hinted at, indicated. You cannot be convinced of the truth. You can only be persuaded. And the master is one who is not going to convince you of the truth, but who is going to seduce you into truth. Parables are very seductive. Even those who were not searching for any truth may be suddenly struck by a parable. Something may become suddenly available to them. And people like stories. And the stories have a tendency to hang around your consciousness. It is difficult to forget them. It is very easy to remember them. They have a way to reach to the deepest core of your being. Hence, Sufis have been using parables. It is a totally different world from Zen, Tao, Yoga, Tantra. I welcome you into the world of Sufis today. It is more artistic, more poetic, more aesthetic, and its ways are very subtle. A certain man decided that he would seek the perfect master. Now to decide is wrong, because the decision will come out of your past experiences. One cannot decide to seek a perfect master. One can only become available in a passive way. Seeking, decision are active ways. One has to be more feminine. One should not be in such a hurry. One should be more watchful, more alert what one is trying to do. Have you known any master before? Have you any experience of a master? Whatsoever you have heard is borrowed. You are not certain, you cannot be certain of its truth. How you are going to decide? And how you will seek a master? What will be the criterion of judgment? How you will weigh that this is really a perfect master? Are you capable of weighing, judging a perfect master? Then you are higher. You are already higher than the perfect master. You are sitting in the seat of a judge. You are not a humble, passive disciple. And the master happens only in your passivity, in your humbleness, in your simplicity. A certain man decided that he would seek the perfect master. And why the perfect master? The ego always seeks perfection. If you are after money, the ego wants you to be the richest man in the world, the most perfect man in the world. If you are after morality, You want to become the most perfect saint. The ego has a very, very deep desire to be perfect. All egoists are perfectionists. And all perfectionists are neurotic. The idea of perfection drives people mad. A humble person knows imperfections. And a humble person accepts his imperfections. And a humble person does not ask for the impossible. It is the ego that always asks for the impossible and fails and feels frustrated, betrayed, cheated. But again, it starts asking the same thing. Why do you need a perfect master? You have taken one thing for granted, that you are such a great man, that less than that will not be worth, will not be satisfying. Less than that will be below you. You are such a perfect man, you need a perfect master. Ordinary masters won't do. Something extraordinary has to be. Only you can be interested in the extraordinary. And the paradox is that the extraordinary exists in a very ordinary way. The extraordinary never exists as the extraordinary. Because all those pretensions of being extraordinary are foolish and stupid. A real man, an authentic man, has no idea of being superior in any way to anybody else. He lives in a world where comparison does not exist. Now, the very idea of seeking a perfect master is based in comparison. A certain man decided that he would seek the perfect master. He read many books. But how can you find a master by reading many books? You will become more and more stuffed with knowledge, and that will be the barriers. But that's what happens. Somebody starts thinking of God, our truth, our beauty. He starts reading books. He thinks there is a way to find it. I am reminded of a great Indian poet, Rabindranath Tagore. He was continuously thinking about beauty, what it is. A poet naturally is interested in beauty. His mind was meditating on what beauty is. One full moon night, he was in his boat. And the night was just majestic. The full moon in the sky and the silence of the river and the forests around. And he was alone in the boat. Just once in a while, a bird may call. That was all. And then the silence will become deeper than before. But he was pondering over the question, what is beauty? And he was looking into an ancient scripture. He had only a small candle burning in the cabin. Tired in the middle of the night, frustrated, because even in that old scripture he could not find something real about beauty. just words and words and words. He blew the candle out and he could not believe his eyes. Suddenly, as he blew the candle out, from the windows, from the door, the moonlight immediately came in. He was transplanted into another world. He rushed out. He looked at the moon, at the silence of the night, and the moon reflected in the river, and the whole river silvery, and the deep, dense forest on the bank. And this was beauty. And he was looking into the book. And beauty was waiting for him, just waiting on the door. But that small yellow candlelight was preventing the splendor of the night. And he became so much engaged and occupied with the thoughts of the scripture that he had forgotten completely that this is a full moon night. He threw the scripture into the river. And that was the last day he ever thought about beauty. He said, thinking won't help. Beauty is there. We have to be available to it. He said, we have to blow out the candle, the small candle of the ego, and the God comes in many ways, and the beauty penetrates you. But that's what happens. If you start thinking of finding a perfect master, you will go into the books to know who is a perfect master. Now books will confuse you, because every book will say a different story. If you read a Jaina book, it simply describes Mahavira and says these are the characteristics of a perfect master. They are not. They are the characteristics of a particular perfect master, Mahavira. If you read a Buddhist book, they also describe the characteristics of a perfect master. They are also not. But only of one manifestation of the perfect master, Buddha. And so on and so forth. And once you get caught into some conclusions from the books, you start searching. But your search is doomed to fail from the very beginning. You have already a priori prejudice. Now you are looking for Buddha and Buddha is never repeated. Now you are looking for Zarathustra and Zarathustra is only once and never again. Now you are looking for Lao Tzu and Lao Tzu never comes again. Once is all. Nothing is ever repeated. God's creativity is infinite. He is not repetitive. And if you read a Buddhist, a Confucian, a Taoist, then you will be more confused. Because they describe different things. And you may be a very clever person, intelligent person, intellectual, and you may join all those characteristics together. Now you will never find the perfect master. Now you have an idea which is absolutely absurd. It is like taking one part from a bullock cart, taking another part from a Rolls Royce, and putting them together. And parts from cycles and parts from engines, you will have something strange, but it won't work. Even a bullock cart is better than that. Howsoever is slow, but you can go through, you can reach somewhere, you can use it. This will be utterly useless, this monster that you have created. And that's what happens. People who read many scriptures and many books, they slowly, slowly create an idea of who is the perfect master. And this idea is just a combination of many characteristics taken, collected from different sources. It is not possible. Such a man has never existed, and such a man is never going to exist. Now you are searching for a marriage. You will never find it. And you may come across many masters, but because of your idea, you will go on rejecting them, because something or else will be lacking in him. It is because of your idea that you are missing. Not that masters are not there. They are always. The world is full of masters always. And God is not a miser, remember. Jews say that there are only 36 masters in the world at a time. Just 36? Is God such a miser? And why 36? But still Jews are generous, if you think of other religions. Jainas say that there are only 24 perfect masters in the whole of creation, from the beginning to the end. One creation, from the beginning to the end, that means millions and millions of ages. Only 24? So for millions of years there is not a single master available. Hindus are a little even more miser. They say only 10. Christians are even more. They say God has only one son, Jesus Christ. Only Jesus Christ is the perfect master. Nobody else. Then how can you find a perfect master? I say to you, God is generous. There is no limitation. There is no fixed number. Masters go on happening. Just people are blind. People are deaf. This hurts. To know that you are blind and deaf, this hurts. That's why these theories have appeals. 24 only. 10 only, 1 only. That is a great consolation to you, remember. That means if you have not found the perfect master, what can you do? It is not your responsibility. Only once in a while the perfect master happens. And this time he is not here. It is not your fault that you have not found him. If anybody is at fault, it is God, not you. You are relieved. I say to you, perfect masters are always available. Just as roses are always available and lotuses are always available. And the sun rises every morning. And there are millions of stars always available. Just you have to open your eyes. You have not to be blind. But our situation is really in a bad shape. I was reading a story. This is the story of you. A woman had just had a child, but had not yet seen it. She asked the doctor that it be brought to her, but he did not comply. I am afraid it would not be a good idea for you to see him right now. But as she insisted passionately, he began to justify his refusal. You see, madam, Through a most unfortunate accident of fate, your child was born abnormally, and I feel it would be good for you to recover fully from the delivery before seeing your child. Tell me, doctors, I must know what has happened. I must see my child. The doctor, wishing to spare her the sight of her child, ventured to explain to her the nature of the deformity. I will be blunt, madam. Your child has no legs. She gasped, but recovering from the blow, she composed herself and asked to see the child. Madam, wishing to spare you the naked truth, I have omitted to tell you the whole situation. Your child has neither legs nor arms. Doctor, she cried, bring me my child. He will have my legs and my arms. I must see him. I see, he replied. I must be even more cruel. Your child has no torso either. No legs, no arms, no torso. She sobbed, bring him to me. He needs me all the more. The doctor finally conceded and brought her the baby. She started as she saw it. Wrapped in a towel was a foot-long ear. She looked the ear. She took the ear and rocked it comfortingly. It will be all right, dear. We will make it somehow. The doctor interrupted her, madam, you are wasting your breath. The child is deaf. That's the situation man is in. You are blind, you are deaf, you have no heart. But to see it hurts. It is painful to realize it, to recognize it. So we go on finding explanations how to avoid the truth about ourselves. The disciple is not ready. That's why he cannot see the master. But he goes on saying there is no master. I was a student in a university, and it was Buddha's Enlightenment Day. It was celebrated in the university. And the vice chancellor said, with great passion and with great emotion, that if I had been in Buddha's time, I would have renounced the world, sat in his feet, followed him like a shadow. And I knew the man. I could not conceive him ever following a Buddha. I had to stand up. And I said, you please take your words back. Because I know you perfectly well. You are the last man who would have followed Buddha. And do you think Buddhas are not available now? Had you ever been to Maharishi Raman? He had to say that no. But he was alive just few years before. He was alive. He was your contemporary. This incident happened somewhere near 1955, and Raman died in 51, just 4 years before. And the vice chancellor was an old man of 70. I said he was your contemporary. Arunachal is not very far away. In Buddha's time, it may have taken you years to journey to Buddha. It was only 1 hour's flight. Had you been there? Have you been to Jai Krishnamurti ever? He is still alive. And you are talking with such emotion and passion, whom you are trying to befool. But he was a good man. He understood the point. Tears came to his eyes. He took his words back. Later on, he called me and he said, listen, if you have to say something to me, you can come in private. Why private? You had made the statement in public. I had to refute it in public. And never make such a statement, because I will be still here for 2-3 years. Think over it. You were in Buddha's time too, I told him. He was startled. He said, how do you know? I said, I know. You just look into my eyes. You were in Buddha's time too. But you never went. And now you are talking with such emotion. You are deceiving others, but that is not the big thing. You are deceiving yourself. People go on thinking that masters used to happen only in the past. Now they don't happen. Now they are no more there. And the same was the case in Buddha's time. There are stories, people will come and ask Buddha, are you the perfect master? There were people who will go to Jesus and will ask, are you the Messiah we were waiting for? The Messiah is there, standing in front of their eyes, in front of them. And they are asking, are you the Messiah? If he says no, they will be happy. If he says yes, they will be offended. Jesus said yes, that's why they were offended. So this pretender thinks he is the Messiah. This son of a carpenter, Joseph, and we know him from his childhood. He has been playing in the streets of the town, and now suddenly he has become the Messiah. They have been always asking. In Buddha's time, they were saying, in the past, there used to be perfect masters. In the days of Upanishads, in the days of Vedas, there used to be perfect masters. But now, in these ugly days, they have all disappeared. And they go on saying the same thing now. And they will go on saying the same thing forever. They really don't want to see. A certain man decided that he would seek the perfect master. He read many books, visited sage after sage, listened, discussed, practiced, but he always found himself doubting or unsure. You can read, you can argue, you can become very logical about it, but nothing is going to help. The doubt will persist unless you experience. Only experience kills doubt. But how to experience a master? You have to be a disciple first. You have to fulfill that requirement. And what is the requirement of a disciple? Prayerfulness is the requirement of disciplehood. Capacity to wait. Capacity to be empty. Capacity to surrender. Capacity to be available. That's what prayer is. And if you know how to pray, you will know all that is needed to know. Not only you will come across a perfect master, you are going to come across God himself. Meditate over these words of Rainer Maria Rilke. Pray to whom? I cannot tell you. Prayer is a radiation of our being suddenly set afire. It is an infinite and purposeless direction, a brutal accompaniment of our hopes, which travel the universe without reaching any destination. Ah, but I knew this morning how far I am from those greedy ones who before praying ask whether God exists. If he no longer or does not yet exist, what difference does it make? My prayer that will bring him into being. For it is entirely a creative thing as it lifts towards the heavens. And if the God that it projects out of itself does not persist at all, so much the better. We will do it over and it will be less sebi in eternity. Prayer creates God. Prayer creates the perfect master. Prayer is creative. Prayer reveals, it is revelatory. It prepares you for the revelation. One should not go in search of a master. One should learn how to pray. And the master comes. And the master comes on his own accord. Or he calls you forth wherever you are. But then the journey is totally different when you are called forth. The quality is different. The intensity is different. You don't feel you are going. You feel you are being called. You know that there is no possibility to resist it. It is irresistible. You are pulled as if a great magnet is pulling you. You are helpless. But you are thrilled because you have been chosen. You come dancing. You are fortunate you have been chosen. Just prepare wherever you are. Don't ask if there is no perfect master, what is the point of preparing for disciplehood? Don't be worried. The masters always exist. That is the meaning of these beautiful words of Rilke. Prayer is a radiation of our being suddenly set afire. It is an infinite and purposeless direction. In the beginning, you don't know where your prayer is going. It cannot have any address. It cannot have any direction. How can you pray to God? You don't know God. That's why you are praying. You would like to know what God is, but you don't know. That's why you are pouring your heart. It is waiting for the unknown to take possession of you. This is faith. This is trust. The skeptical mind wants first to be certain. Whether there is a God, then I will pray. Rilke is right. But I knew this morning how far I am from those greedy ones who before praying ask whether God exists. We will pray only if God exists. Then you will never pray. Because you will never know without praying that God exists. You have made an impossible condition to pray. It is not to be fulfilled. You have to pray. Don't ask the question whether God exists or not. God is irrelevant at the point. At the point, make prayer possible. Prayer is a song of the heart addressed to the unknown. Maybe he is, maybe he is not, but that is not the point. One is joyous in pouring one's heart. It is a joy unto itself. Whether God exists or not is secondary. Prayer is primary. And when prayer is primary, it reveals God. It opens your eyes. It creates God. Suddenly the world becomes afire when you are afire. When your heart is aflame, suddenly you see the whole world aflame with divine. With the unknown, with the mysterious. If he no longer or does not exist, what difference does it make? This is beautiful. This is how a really religious person thinks. My prayer, that will bring him into being. Prayer will become the womb. I will give birth to God through my prayers. This is the Sufi approach. Rilke is almost reflecting the very heart of Sufism. But this is how always lovers have felt, and the poets and the mystics. If he no longer or does not yet exist, what difference does it make? My prayer that will bring him into being, for it is entirely a creative thing as it lifts toward the heavens. And if the God that projects out of itself does not persist at all, so much the better. We will do it over, and it will be less sebi in eternity. We will go on doing. We will go on creating God. In fact, it is not creation. It is revelation. But for the person who prays and God is revealed for the first time, it looks like creation, as if the prayer has created it. It reveals. It takes a thick layer of darkness from your eyes. Your heart starts pulsating as it should. You fall in rhythm with the whole. Suddenly God is there. But before God appears, appears the Master. Master is a link between you and the God. First, the prayer reveals the Master. That is one step and the half journey. And the second step, and the journey is complete. Prayer is naive. It is waiting for someone who never comes, asking for something or someone who is not there, not at least now. If there be a God who loves man, let him speak now. This is what the poet Seneca says in his tragedy, Thestes. The prayerful heart is saying that I am speaking to you. I am provoking you. Are you there? Just give me a little hint. A small word, a gesture, and that will do. Are you there? And 1,001 times you shout to the skies and there is no response. Your prayer disappears into nothingness. But even though the prayer disappears into nothingness and there is no response from the other side, from the other soul, still the prayer goes on changing you. The effects are very visible. It may not change the reality outside you, but it goes on changing you. You become softer and softer, more feminine and more feminine. And one day, when you have really melted, when you are no more hard and solid, when you are a flow, the response comes, and not from the other soul, but from the innermost core of your being. Really, that is the other soul. But before that happens, you will come to the link between this soul and the other, between this and that. That link is the Master. And in fact, to ask for a perfect Master is foolish, because to be a Master is to be perfect. It is a repetition of words. There are not such categories, imperfect masters and perfect masters. A master is perfect. If he does not look perfect to you, then you have a certain idea of perfection that he is not fulfilling. He never fulfills anybody's idea. He lives his own life. But he lives in perfection. Remember, When I use the word perfection, I always use in the sense of completion. I never use it in the sense you use it. This is a constant problem. When I say perfection, you start thinking that he will be like this, he will be like that, that he will never be angry. But there have been masters who have been angry, and when they are angry, they are perfectly angry. Even Ramana Maharishi, such a silent sage, used to become sometimes angry. And then he was really angry. He was anger, pure anger. One day it happened, a scholar came and started asking stupid questions. Raman listened. His questions were very long. And he will quote scriptures to support his question. And Raman said again and again, "You please meditate. The only thing is, you ask the question, who am I? No other question is relevant." But the man won't listen. And he will go on and on and on. Suddenly, the disciples could not believe. Raman took his staff, rushed after the man, and the man became so afraid that he escaped outside the room, and Raman followed him to the very boundary of the ashrama. And then he came back laughing. The disciples could not believe, and they said, "But you and angry?" And he said, "Look at the perfection of it." If you have the idea that a master is never angry, should not be angry, then there will be difficulties. If you have the idea that a master should not look worried, you will have difficulties. Krishnamurti sometimes looks very worried. He has no worry of his own, but he becomes worried about you. He goes on saying one thing and people don't understand, and they go on persisting in their ignorance, and he becomes very, very angry, almost on the verge of beating himself. One man came to me and he said, "I used to think that Krishnamurti must be like a Buddha. But today I saw him in his discourse. He became so angry. And for no reason at all." I said, "You just tell me the whole story." He said he was talking about that no method is needed. No meditation is needed. You have to drop all methods, all meditations, all paths. And then an old woman, a very old woman, stood up and asked how to do it. And he became very angry. I said, "I know that old woman, because she comes to me too. And I can understand. I feel all sympathy with Krishnamurti." And that woman has been listening to Krishnamurti almost for 50 years. She is one of the constant audiences. And she is always sitting in that corner for 50 years. Whenever Krishnamurti comes to Bombay, she is there. Krishnamurti must be getting tired of her also. And she always asks the how. And he is telling continuously that there is no how. A method means how. When we say that there is no method, we are saying there is no how. Either be enlightened right now or remain unenlightened. That is your decision. But there is no how. Decide to be or not to be. But don't ask how. There is no how. Either open your eyes and see, otherwise, keep your eyes closed and dream. But don't ask how. And for 50 years he has been saying the same thing and the woman persists. And she always stands and asks, how to do it? It is natural. He is not really angry in the sense you become angry. It is his response. It is his compassion, really. It has a different quality. He is compassionate. He loves. He wants to help. But when he says you go on and on in the same rut to shake you up, he becomes absolute anger. The idea of perfection in your mind is that he should be like this, he should be like that, he should be like. He is not like anybody else. He is just like himself. Only one thing is true, that he is always total. Whatsoever he is doing, he is total in it. He is never partial, never fragmentary. If he is angry, then he is totally angry. If he is loving, he is totally loving. That totalness is the only quality. That's what I mean by perfection. All masters are perfect. So there is no question of searching for a perfect master. Become more and more of a disciple. That is where you have to start the journey. He read many books, visited sage after sage, listened, discussed and practiced, but he always found himself doubting or unsure. After 20 years, he met a man whose every word and action corresponded with his idea of the totally realized man. Now, he was carrying for 20 years a certain idea. He was looking for a carbon copy. He had already decided what a perfect master is. Now, all that was needed is somebody to fit with his idea. And remember, it is his idea that somebody else has to fit. This is ego, pure ego. This is not humbleness. This is not the way of a disciple. This is not the way of a humble man. This is not the way of a real seeker. He is functioning through a conclusion. He has already decided that his conclusion is right. How can your conclusions be right? If your conclusions are right, you yourself are a perfect master and there is no need for any master. After 20 years, he met a man whose every word and action corresponded with his idea of the totally realized man. Must have been a coincidence. The traveler lost no time. You, he said, seem to me to be the perfect master. If you are, my journey is at an end. But see, still the if persists. Because he has a certain conclusion already arrived at in his ignorance, how can he trust it? If he cannot find somebody to correspond with his idea, he is not a master. If you find somebody who corresponds just by coincidence, now the great doubt arises. Maybe his idea is right. Maybe his idea is wrong. Hence the if. So he says, you seem to me to be the perfect master if you are. My journey is at an end. I am indeed described by that name, said the master. Because for a master, all these are just names. Call him a Buddha, call him an enlightened person, a Christ, a Messiah, a perfect master. These are just names. They don't describe his reality. These are just labels. Maybe people need them. But the master does not need them. He has come home where all words have become meaningless. He has come to that silence where words don't exist, to that wordless silence. So the master says, I am indeed described by that name. He does not say, I am or I am not. He simply says, yes, people describe me by that name. Then I beg of you, accept me as a disciple. But this man has not prepared himself as a disciple at all. And now suddenly he wants him to be accepted. That, said the master, I cannot do. For while you may desire the perfect master, he in turn requires only the perfect pupil. ट्वेंटी ईयर्स सर्च वेस्टेड. ट्वेंटी ईयर्स सर्च गॉन डाउन द ड्रेन. एंड द मास्टर इज राइट. ही सेज, व्हाट डू यू थिंक? इफ यू वांट ए परफेक्ट मास्टर, देन द परफेक्ट मास्टर वांट्स ए परफेक्ट डिसाइपल. गो बिकम परफेक्ट. Go become a disciple first. People think disciplehood is nothing to be attained. It needs great discipline to become a disciple. Both words, discipline and disciple, mean the same. The original root means the capacity to learn. This man is incapable of learning. 20 years he has been moving with his set conclusions. He has not learnt a thing. 20 years he has come across many sages. But he has valued his own ideas more than those sages. He has not looked at the reality of those beings that he has come across. He has remained tethered to his ego. And now, he says, because you correspond to my ideas, I think you are the perfect master. Not that you are the perfect master, but just only because you correspond to my ideas. Now, who are you? And how your ideas can decide? How can they be decisive? From where you have gathered, from books, from discussions, from arguments, they are all borrowed. And in your ignorance, you have gathered all kind of nonsense. In fact, when you read a book, you don't understand what is written there. You understand only that which your ignorance can understand. How can you understand Quran? To understand Quran, you will need the heart of a Muhammad. How can you understand Gita? To understand Gita, you will need Krishna consciousness. Listen to a few stories. Mummy, said little Jimmy, I want to live with Carol next door. But you are both only 6 years old, smiled his mother. Where will you live? In her bedroom. What will you live off? You don't have any money. And what will you do if babies come along? Well, said Jimmy seriously, we have been all right so far. And if she lays any eggs, then I will tread on them. The man in ignorance is almost like a child, like this child Jimmy. What ideas you can have of perfection, of a master, of a God, your ideas will be childish. And you will go on understanding that which you can understand. And words are always vague. They don't really carry meaning. The meaning has to be projected by you in the words. The word is just empty. You have to fill it with your meaning. Two hippies are slipping and sliding through the Louisiana marshlands. As one hippie stepped up onto dry land, the other hippie said, "Hey man, an alligator just bit off my leg." "Which one?" The first hippie said, "I don't know, man. I can't tell one alligator from another." Words don't have meaning. It depends on you, what meaning you are going to give to them. A doctor was called to see a lady who led a very gay life. When asked to explain how she felt, she remarked, "I have not slept much lately. Last night, we dined at the Carlton after the theater and then had drinks. I really feel that my stomach is out of order." "I am quite sure of it," he said. "You will have to diet." "Ah, doctor, how lovely," she said. "What color?" An Irishman visiting America remarked about the strange American customs. "You take a glass of ginger ale," he said, "and add whiskey to make it strong, and then water to make it weak, lemon to make it sour, and sugar to make it sweet. You raise the glass and say, 'Here is to you,' and then you drink it down yourself." When you see something, you read something, you give meaning to it. It is always your meaning. It can't be otherwise. So you can go on reading as many books as possible, and you will gather much rubbish, but the meaning will be yours. You can quote the Bible, but you will be simply quoting yourself. And that has happened down the ages. When one scripture is translated into another language, much changes into it. It has happened to the Bible. Because Jesus spoke in Aramaic, then it was translated into Hebrew, then into Greek, then from Greek into English. It has been translated so many times. Its original fragrance is completely lost. It is no more the same. It has been translated so many times. Its original fragrance is completely lost. It is no more the same. It can't be. So many interpreters, so many translators stand in between. They have given their own meaning to it. In John 8:24, we read, "Except ye believe that I am He, ye shall die in your sins." But here the word "He" is not found in the original manuscript at all. The early translators were puzzled by the absence of an object, and thus they simply assumed that a word was missing. They changed the statement. "Except ye believe that I am." This is the original statement. "Except ye believe that I am." They had to change it. It looks incomplete. Who are you? Just saying "I am"? It looks incomplete. So they made it read, except you believe that I am He, I am God. Thus the beauty and the immense significance of the original was lost. It is still that way in the Bible. I am He. Jesus is simply saying, I am. That I amness is the very quality of existence. He is not saying, I am God. Because if you say, I am God, you have already accepted the duality of I and God. Then the am is only a bridge between the duality. When Jesus says, I am, He is simply saying, you can call it God or you can call it I. It is the same thing. Two ways of expressing the same thing. This is far better, far more superior than the Upanishadic statement that says, Thou art that. It has accepted the duality. To deny, it has accepted. It denies, it says, Thou art that. But the duality is accepted. Jesus is far more superior in His statement when He says, I am. Moses asked God when he met Him on the mountain top, that people will ask me about you, how I am to say anything about you. And He said, just go and tell them that God says, I am that I am. Strange words, but of great significance. When Jesus speaks, He speaks from His consciousness. He pours His consciousness into it. But when it reaches to you, only the empty word reaches. His spirit is lost in the way. Then you fill that empty word with your own spirit. And you call it, you have read in the Bible, or you have read in the Quran, or in the Veda. But you are reading only yourself. All scriptures function as mirrors. You see only your face. And remember, if a monkey looks into a mirror, he is not going to find an angel there. This man read, listened, discussed, practiced, but the doubt remained. 20 years searching, he came across many sages, but could not feel contented with any. He would not have felt contented even if God was encountered. And maybe, who knows, he may have encountered God too. Because God comes in so many sizes and shapes. There is a story about a great mystic. The mystic was Mohammedan. And he lived in a mosque. But he had a Hindu follower. The Hindu was a Brahmin. And the Hindu will cook food for him and will bring to the mosque. And he used to live 5 miles away from the mosque. And unless the master will eat, he will sit there and wait. And the master was a crazy man. Sometimes he will eat in the morning, sometimes in the afternoon, sometimes in the evening, sometimes in the night. And the disciple will wait, and he will not eat till the master has eaten. So sometimes he had to remain hungry the whole day. And by the time he will reach home, he was so tired that he may think, tomorrow. Now, who wants to prepare food again? He will fall asleep, hungry. One day the master said, you listen, you need not come so far. I can come myself there. So tomorrow you prepare the food and I will come. This is too hot to come. and then sometimes you have to wait for the whole day. Change it now. You are ready. I will come. The next day, he prepared delicious food for the master because he was to come for the first time. He was thrilled. This was grace. His master is coming to his home. He decorated the house. He threw flowers on the path. But nobody turned up, only a dog. He chased the dog out because the dog wanted to eat. And he will chase and the dog will come back and will try to snatch food. He had seen many dogs, but this dog was strange. He begged the dog, but he will still come. He really gave him a good beating. Then he saw tears coming out of the dog's eyes, and then he disappears. Till evening he waited, and then he thought, this man is crazy, he may have forgotten. So he took the food, went to the mask, and he saw tears in the eyes of the master, the same kind of tears. He was puzzled, and he said, why are you crying? And he said, why should not I? You have beaten me so much. And the disciple said, what are you talking about? I and can beat you? And you never came and you had promised? And the master said, I came, and not only once, at least 12 times. And then the disciple remembered the dog. Exactly 12 times the dog had tried to enter. And the master said, you have to be capable to see the formless now. Don't be too much attached with the form. Why I should be only thought in this form, in this body? Why can't you find me in other forms? So I say, maybe this great seeker had come across God. In fact, how can you avoid God? Whomsoever you come across, you always come across God. But he had great ideas, and even God could not fulfill those ideas. He remained empty, doubtful, untrusting, and the search continued. And one day when he comes to a man who fulfills his ideas, he creates another problem. He says, that I cannot do, I cannot accept you as a disciple, for while you may desire the perfect master, he in turn requires only the perfect pupil. The master is saying, had you prepared yourself these 20 years to be a disciple, you would have found me much earlier. You came across me many times, but you missed. And this time also you have to miss. This is the Sufi approach to have a contact and communion with a master. Become a disciple. Don't search for the master. Search for disciplehood. And let me repeat, the master appears when the disciple is ready. Enough for today.